Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. We've got a great show for you. We're going to talk a little about cation exchange capacity and why that's important to know. If you've got any questions for us or if you'd like to talk about anything happening in your farm right now, our number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. Or email us radio@agphd.com. So this cation exchange capacity thing, and we're not going to spend the whole show on it. We are going to take your questions, and we're certainly going to get to the Ag PhD mailbag here in just a little bit as well. But this cation exchange capacity thing is really important, and I just want to explain to you why. So for us as agronomists, we're trying to help you out all the time as much as we can, especially looking at soil tests. We need to know, is it heavy soil or is it light soil? And everybody's definition of that is different, right? So I'll just give you a quick example. When I go to the southern United States, I'll go to states like Alabama, for example, and I'll talk to somebody, they'll talk to me about their heavy ground. Then I look at their soil test, and it's 10 for cation exchange capacity. So I'll go up into Canada. It was up there, I think it must have been 2 years ago, and I will never forget this because it just cracked me up. And the guy comes up, and he hands me a soil test, and he goes, yeah, I got this sandy ground, and I don't know what to do with it. What do you think? And I look at it, and I go, it's a 33 cation exchange capacity. That's not sand. I mean, you may call that sand. And he goes, well, I do because here's my heavy ground. It was a 41 cation exchange capacity. I'm going, okay, you're heavy and super heavy, all right? But nothing here is sand, okay? Nothing is sand. But that's the point, because if we don't know what that is, then it messes us up a little bit in terms of recommendations for everything from nitrogen to pre-emerge residual herbicides. So we really want to know what that number is. That'll help us. And lime is another thing. We've had lots of questions about lime lately. Well, if you have heavier soil, you have a higher cation exchange capacity number, you need more lime to fix the same pH as someone who has lighter soil. You need more tile to fix a drainage issue versus someone with a lighter soil. So when we have that cation exchange capacity, now it's like we're all speaking the same language, so we know where we're coming from. So anyway, that is very important to have in your soil test, and it's not going to change much. How it gets calculated is basically the type of clay you have in your soil, the amount of clay you have in your soil, and the amount of organic matter that's in your soil. So obviously, you're not going to change your clay unless you physically take the clay off the fields. That's realistically never going to happen. But what can change is the organic matter. And I'm not going to say it has a super dramatic impact on cation exchange capacity, but it does have an impact. So if you can work on, over the lifetime of your farming career, building up your soil's organic matter by, let's say, 2 or 3 points, then that's going to give you a higher cation exchange capacity, and it's going to give you your soil more ability to hold water and nutrients, herbicide, everything. So anyway, that's cation exchange capacity in a nutshell. Like I say, we'll talk about that a little bit throughout the show. But right now, let's get to the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's now mailbag time with Brian and Darren.
All right, Brian, raising calcium levels is the topic of this question. And this is from Scott in South Dakota. He said, my pH is at 7.4. My magnesium base saturation percentage is 25%. Calcium or potassium is up to 8% now. Calcium 65, phosphate's pretty high, sulfur's pretty high too. Adding lime at 98%, will this help lower my pH or will it just add to my calcium levels? I'm considering adding 300 pounds of SuperCal 98. Just wonder if this makes sense to you.
I would not do that. And the reason why, is it possible that it could lower the pH? Yeah, we do see some people who especially have pH in the 8s. They have such high magnesium levels, and just getting more calcium there makes the soil a little bit more porous, and that does seem to help, and it can lower the pH just a little bit. But in your case, I don't really see it. You've already got 65% calcium. There's no point in adding more lime. You already have a high pH, and you definitely don't want to push that pH any further. If you wanted to add some gypsum, you certainly could do that. But even that, I don't I just don't see the point in throwing more calcium out there. You have a lot of calcium already. If anything, I would consider adding some elemental sulfur, and hopefully you can get your sulfur or your sulfate to combine with that magnesium to some degree and flush a little bit of that out. By the way, magnesium sulfate is Epsom salts, and that's leachable. So if it was me, I would be using some elemental sulfur. I'm not saying you need to get carried away. Your 7.4 pH isn't horrible. Your 25% magnesium isn't horrible. Are both factors higher than we'd like to see and somewhat limiting to corn, soybean, and wheat yields? Yes. Is it anything super dramatic, though? No. So personally, I would look at all the other nutrients I've got. I'd make sure I have everything else in great shape first. If I do, so let's just say I had 100 parts per million of phosphorus, I had 10 parts per million on zinc, I had my copper up to 2 or 3, I've got my boron at 2-3 parts per million, I've got literally everything else on that soil test fixed, then I would start investing my money in, you know what, I got to get that. I would like to try to work on reducing my magnesium a little bit. But your calcium's fine, your potassium's fine, your pH is just a little on the high side.
All right, thanks for the question. One other one here, Brian. This comes from Graham up in Ontario. He said, I've read that gypsum can loosen up soil in clay soils. Would you recommend this, or what would you do?
Well, it can, but here again is where I would like to see that soil test. If you need both calcium and sulfur, then yes, gypsum is a good way to go. If, let's say, I have a low pH and I need calcium, I'm putting lime out there. So it really depends on what things look like. In the last example, we were just talking about, you know, adding more calcium to a soil that already has high calcium. There's not going to be this tremendous benefit. And there, maybe you just use a sulfur product and call it good. So lots of options, but yeah, it's not an automatic to use gypsum in all cases. Well, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. Reclaim that lost yield with the End Zone Bin System from Farm Shop MFG.
You're looking for soybeans that give you the yield you want. But when it comes to fighting your toughest weeds, you also need flexibility. Introducing Extend Flex Soybeans. Elite genetics with triple tolerance to dicamba, glyphosate, and glufosinate. The yield you want, the choice you need. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about cation exchange capacity. And it's interesting, as we were kind of prepping for the show, talking to Janelle about this, she's like, man, some of our guests say, can't you pick a more exciting topic? And I'll start off with our first guest here, Reed Abbott with AgroLiquid. Reed, don't you think cation exchange capacity is a pretty exciting topic to be discussing?
It sure can be if you're looking to manage it, right?
Exactly. You know, here's all these things. It's just one of those things you find out about your soil. Okay, I'm at an 8 for a cationic change capacitor. I'm at a 28. That isn't really going to change. You're not going to make that 8 to 28, and it doesn't really matter if it's an 8 or a 28. You can get high yields on either, but when you talk about managing them different, there's certainly some keys here. So, okay, you're covering territory down in Texas and beyond. How in the southern part of the United States, how does this play out? Where, when you have a low CEC versus a high, what are some of the big considerations?
Well, sure. I mean, there's all kinds of – I mean, there you have to look at it and manage them differently, just like you said. I mean, there's not a right or wrong CEC. Generally speaking, as you move west to east in my state, with some exceptions there, obviously, you know, you kind of go from high to low CEC. But, yeah, we certainly face all kinds of challenges with CEC and what guys are looking at with their nutrient makeup.
Now, I know that you can get some storms through your area, and you certainly see some differences in terms of water holding capacity with higher CECs being able to hold water better. Do you have different nutrient recommendations there in terms of leachables?
Well, I mean, yes, certainly, you know, if we're, a lot of it has to do with timing, you know, and those application methods, whether you go way early pre-plant or in season. But, yeah, I mean, we've got the capacity to have hurricanes. We've got the capacity to have, you know, these big frontal systems that'll dump, upwards of 10 inches, sometimes, you know, and if you've got very little, nutrient holding capacity in your soil, you could really run into some challenges there if you're not careful how you're applying those nutrients.
How about with the in-furrow applications? Do you have different limits set for the guys with the lower CECs than you do for the heavy soils?
Absolutely, yeah. The lower CECs, I mean, you're going to increase your risk there if you're getting into some of those higher volumes of in-furrow application. We tell guys, you know, to certainly watch it when they get down there, typically lower than 8. You know, most guys don't have problems above 8 or 10 there, you know, with the standard rates of in-furrow applications. But, you know, you start getting into some of those pretty sandy soils. I mean, I guess that's, it's all relative. I go to some places and an 8 is a heavy clay, you know, and you go to other places and an 8 would be a super high sandy soil. So, but, you know, typically if you're over 8, you're not going to have any issues. 5 to 8, you need to start being cautious and you know, below 5, really, you know, be talking to your supplier to make sure that what you're doing is safe. So,
how about in those situations where you can't put a whole lot on with the planter? Do you have a lot more foliar in those fields?
We do find that guys will use a lot of foliars. I mean, you know, there's also 2x2 applications. And I mean, you know, these days it seems like there's a ton of different ways that guys are putting out fertilizer, both in timing and placement. So, you know, I just tell a guy to look at all of his options and consider, you know, what best fits his farm.
All right, Reed, don't get a chance to talk to you often enough. How are things going down in your part of the world? Did guys have a good year?
I think guys had a pretty fair year. You know, yeah, I think everything came out just fine. I mean, there was some hurricane activity, obviously, in certain parts, but I think overall the South has fared pretty well.
That's good to hear. Yeah, we kind of all need a good year, especially coming out of 2020 here. All right, talking to Reed Abbott with AgriLiquid. Reed, thank you so much, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, you too. Thanks.
Let's head out to Ohio. Get Steve Coleman with us right now at Ohio State University. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I was thinking about Ohio, and I was thinking about our topic today, cation exchange capacity, and also how many growers have gone to no-till and reduced till. Does soil cation exchange capacity or heavy or light soil have anything to do with their choice to move more no-till, or is it something else?
Well, yeah, I think that's a good question. There's a lot of course, factors that determine if a grower is going to practice no-till or what type of tillage that they're going to use. Certainly the how heavy or light a soil might be, you know, as measured or as kind of estimated by CEC, has something to do with that and the timing of those tillage operations. We find that there's a lot more, say, fall tillage that might happen, some primary tillage that happens in the fall on heavier ground, just because it's hard to, you know, the slower draining soils in the springtime, it's hard to get on and get that work done.
Sure.
So some of that, yeah, I guess it probably depends on a number of things, not just the CEC in that regard.
You know, another topic that we've heard a lot about has been soil health. And I know in the state of Ohio, certainly there's a lot of growers concerned about that. What are the questions that you're getting around soil health and just building up their soils?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to think of soil health in kind of two main ways. One is that thinking about it from a quantification perspective, how do we actually measure it and kind of estimate what we're dealing with? And that's usually kind of often a laboratory issue. And then the second piece is just in terms of management, or how, you know, what are the things that I can do on my farm to improve soil health? And so there's a, you know, like a lot of places, there's a whole kind of growing interest in this and thinking about what are the management tools that growers have available so that they can tackle or try to improve their soils. Anything from, for example, you know, tillage and tillage practices to cover crops and any sort of use of manure or other kind of organic amendments to help kind of boost the microbial life.
One of the other things I was thinking about when I knew you're going to be on the show today is just asking about fertility levels in the state of Ohio. I know there's a lot of stuff going on. There's certainly been some issues along the lakes and so forth, but also just growers who haven't made a lot of money the last few years that have maybe cut back on some of the P&K that now they're thinking, ooh, I might actually make some money in 2021, so maybe I want to try and build things back up. So it kind of puts them in a tough predicament if they're trying to be really careful about what they do, yet they're trying to build soil levels.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. And of course, you know, growers need to run a profitable business, and knowing when to decide and, you know, investing in things like soil fertility versus maybe backing off on that is going to be, in lots of ways, an economic decision. We've just, you know, revised our fertilizer recommendations after 5 or 6 years of a lot of on-farm widespread strip trial work with phosphorus and potassium. So, you know, I think that we've taken some of the guesswork out of, or at least provided recommendations that we have a large amount of confidence in. So, you know, I think that I'll just make a plug, because those are really hot off the press, our new recommendations. And if growers are interested in kind of asking those questions or just reassessing what their fertility management regimes are, you know, just take a look at what we found in terms of all of our, you know, our trials, several hundred on-farm trials with growers over about 34 different counties in Ohio. So it's quite a big effort, a lot of work that went into that.
Yeah, it hasn't been easy, I'm sure, to get that much cooperation across the whole state. Way to go, Steve. That's awesome. It's a big project.
Yeah, it's been good. And we're happy with where we're at in terms of the results of that. So happy to share that information. Yep.
Outstanding. Talking to Steve Coleman here with Ohio State University. Steve, thanks for being on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You bet. Yeah, cation exchange capacity and heavy soil versus light soil, certainly some differences in how we're going to manage things and figuring out exactly what our goals are out in those soils is important, because as we were mentioning at start to show off, it doesn't necessarily mean you're in a higher or lower yield environment just because you have a higher or lower cation exchange capacity, but certainly there's going to be some different things that you have to manage to manage on your farm. When you get into those light soils, especially in areas around sensitive water bodies and so forth, you're going to have to be careful. We'll talk a little more about cation exchange capacity here on the show today, and also take your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. We'll be right back.
Revitech fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
Fill once, plant all day. The Thrive 3D application system from FMC is a revolutionary in-furrow crop protection platform that plants up to 480 acres between refills. The Thrive 3D application system mounts to most major planter brands and can be yours at no cost with the FMC Freedom Pass program. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
Did you know soybean diseases like white mold and sudden death syndrome can survive in your soil even after rotating crops? Prevention of these diseases is a constant battle, and yield loss from an infection can be devastating. The right management plan makes all the difference. Keep your beans safe next spring with Heads Up Seed Treatment. Heads Up guards your seed treatment from both white mold and SDS. Stay protected and profitable by asking to have your seed pre-treated with Heads Up. Learn more at headsupst.com.
Your soybeans are in the bin, but the game isn't over yet. Score more points this year by taking your beans to the end zone. If your beans went in the bin at low moisture, you can naturally rehydrate to reclaim lost yield with the End Zone Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. At $10 beans, every point of moisture below your target takes away 15 cents per bushel. That means raising 9% moisture beans to 13 can increase your profits by 60 cents per bushel. Score more yields in the end zone from Farm Shop MFG.
Got resistant weeds? Add Tough 5EC as your post-emergence tank mix partner to deliver the knockout punch to Palmer amaranth and water hemp. Tough 5EC is a selective contact herbicide for post-emergence control of key broadleaf weeds, especially resistant strains. Tough 5EC is manufactured by Beltrum Crop Protection, an agrochemical company focused on providing innovative products with strong technical support. Ask your local retailer about Tough 5EC or visit BeltrumUSA.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at SoilWarrior.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about cation exchange capacity, but just talking in general about what's going on in soils and managing them this fall. I know there's a lot of folks talking about fall tillage, fall fertilizer, and certainly a lot of that work has been done in many areas of the country. We've got Jim Camberato on with us right now with Purdue. Jim, thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
All right, so what are some of the big soil questions you're getting this fall from farmers in your area?
Well, up until the recent rains, we had a lot of questions about how the excessively dry weather was going to affect soil test and whether they should take samples now or wait till the spring.
Ooh, we had the same questions on our farm. In fact, we had one of our guys was out pulling soil samples. Is not a light man. He's quite heavy, and he couldn't get the probe in the ground early on in the fall till we got some moisture.
Well, we got a fair amount done. So we just told our guys, hey, you got to go ahead. And you might see your pH off a little bit. Your K might be off a little bit. But we got to have some data with which to manage our farms because guys were going to apply fertilizer. So how did you handle that question, Jim?
Right. Yeah, so the first thing is, can you get a full sample depth?
Yep.
Generally, there's a lot of stratification of nutrients and pH.
Yep.
So if your depth varies from year to year, then your results will vary as well.
Definitely.
But basically, I gave the same answer. Your pH might be off. Your potassium might be off. Your other numbers should be fine.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. And if the pH and potassium look a little low, then it could be because of the dry weather.
Yeah. So today we're talking a little about cation exchange capacity. We really like seeing that on a soil test. I wouldn't say it's a commonly accepted thing, though, because a lot of farmers are just looking for N, P, and K. So do you usually recommend that a farmer gets a cation exchange capacity test?
Well, in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan, cation exchange capacity is actually used to make the potassium recommendation.
Sure.
So the higher the CEC, the higher the recommendation for potassium.
Right.
So it's necessary for interpreting our soil test, and most every soil test does have an estimate of cation exchange capacity.
Okay, so you use it for potassium. Is there anything else that you will commonly use it for?
Sometimes in sandy soils that are low in magnesium,
yep,
it's helpful to know the percent magnesium on the cation exchange capacity.
Right.
Typically, you want that to be more than 10%,
yep,
and if it gets close to 5, you're almost assured of having a magnesium deficiency. So that's the other area that I use it frequently.
Yeah, we agree with that 100%. You know, one of the things we also talk to farmers about is tiling. And we spend a lot of time working on drainage with people. And the higher the cation exchange capacity, the heavier the soil. And we like seeing the tile lines at least a little bit closer together. So that's one of the things that we'll use it for. But beyond that, I mean, it's herbicide recommendations too. So, I mean, have you ever even had a farmer ask you about the herbicide recommendation thing? Because it'll literally say on the label, hey, if you have a different soil type, you have to maybe use a little bit more. And I think knowing most farmers that I've ever dealt with, they usually say, well, I'm sure then I just need the low rate. What, do you ever get questions like that?
No, I never get questions related to
yep
that. Now, maybe the weed scientists do, but yeah. So one of the things that's interesting is, you know, sandy soil means something different to everybody.
Exactly.
So I've worked with sandy soils that have cation exchange capacities of 1 or 2
yep
milliequivalents per 100 grams. But in most of Indiana, if farmers have cation exchange capacities of 5, 6, 7, or 8, they claim they have sandy soil.
Exactly.
So. And they aren't.
Yep. Yep. Well, I mean, our dad, he used to tell us, oh, we got this really sandy piece, and, you know, it's like a 12 CEC or something. Well, it's all relative, so I agree 100%. That's for us, the number one reason why we like seeing that CEC number on there, because otherwise you're just dealing with, well, is it heavy or is it light? When you have a specific number, now it's much easier to manage.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so Jim, anything else in terms of soils and questions you might be getting here just lately over in Indiana?
I guess one of the big questions is related to sulfur and whether you can put it out in the winter and have it carry over into the spring. And we generally recommend against that, although we're not 100% sure whether there is some residual carrying over the winter. So that's one question we've been getting.
Well, but wouldn't you say it has a lot to do with the kind of sulfur and when in the winter you're talking about? It's kind of like our sand conversation. Well, winter means something totally different to some people. I mean, for me, in effect, I've already gone into winter. It's freezing here. I don't like it. So I consider now winter. Well, now would be a whole lot different than doing it in early March. And then the other thing would be, is it elemental sulfur, or is it one of those sulfate forms? Because the sulfate forms right could disappear a lot faster than my elemental sulfur that could take a long time to break down. So I assume you kind of talk through that stuff with people too then, right?
Right. Yeah, definitely sulfate versus elemental sulfur. And even with the sulfate, I guess there's a question in those heavier textured soils
yep
that have the higher CEC, how fast the sulfate leaves
sure
the root zone. So.
Yep. Well, the thing about it, Jim, you have to actually have rain for it to leave the root zone.
Right.
And we haven't had a whole lot of rain in a long time. So that's why I haven't been too worried about it here lately. And we get a little bit colder than you guys do a lot of times, too. Our ground is just about to freeze up, and it's typically frozen for 5 months. So, yeah, lots of fun here in the Dakotas. Well, again, we've been talking to Jim Camberato with Purdue. Jim, thanks a lot for the time today. Really appreciate it.
All right. Great to be on. Have a great day.
Yep. You
Thank
too.
You.
Thanks. All right, let's jump back to the Ag PhD mailbag.
Frank, got a question. This is from SM, who said, in alfalfa, how often are you cutting after you plant? How soon can you take that first cutting? Boy, that's a great question. I don't know about after.
All depends on the heat and the moisture.
Yeah, the first cutting, I don't know, but generally a lot of growers now are going about 28 days in between cuttings. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's all heat and moisture for the other thing. How long until your first cutting? So if I have great humidity, great rainfall, adequate soil moisture to begin with, I get great seed to soil contact, I have a nice warm soil, it's not going to take very long. But yeah, it could be a little while if you like to plant in the spring here in the Dakotas, where we're really, really cold and often quite dry.
Got another one, another alfalfa question. This one's from Tom. He said, what is the best way to inject manure between cuttings of alfalfa? I know that injection is usually the best, but I really don't want to tear up the alfalfa stand. Also, thank you for posting your content online.
Well, I got to be honest. Would I do that? No. I would not do that. It just depends,
because an alfalfa stand in one area of the country means something different than an alfalfa stand in another
one.
I mean, there are parts of our state that I would say one plant per square foot would probably qualify as an alfalfa stand. And but, in that case, by all means, inject some nitrogen out there, inject some manure.
Okay. Here's generally speaking how we would encourage you to at least think about approaching some of these perennial crops like alfalfa. Try to get for the life of that stand, let's say you're going to leave it in for 3 years, 4 years, something like that. A lot of the dairies around here, that's what they're commonly doing. Okay, so we got to think about 3 years and 4 years worth of extraction of the non-mobile nutrients, P and K, so you don't have to go injecting things in the ground. Now, if you have manure to get rid of, I totally get that. But what I'm saying here is you're going to hurt that stand that's out there, because most importantly, you're going to cut roots. When you cut roots, that is not a great thing for that stand. And now you also have a little black strip where you're opening it up for weeds to come in. So it's not real great for the alfalfa, but if you have to get rid of manure, you absolutely could. It's tough because you're trying to put lots of volume out. So you want as narrow a coulter as you can find and inject it down. So that's probably what I would do. Well, stay tuned. We got more of your questions right after this.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy. All the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
It's about time. Applied at Planting, new Xyway 3D fungicide from FMC delivers foliar disease protection from planting to harvest. Active ingredient flutriafol moves from the soil through the corn as it grows for inside-out protection from roots to tassel. For season-long protection, choose first-of-its-kind in-furrow Xyway 3D fungicide. To learn more, call 815-362-7747 today. Always read and follow all label directions.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs. Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor Herbicide Brands. Always read and follow label directions.
When it comes to leading herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. Nufarm brings you Cheetah, a high-quality glufosinate herbicide made right here in the USA. Now for use on a wide variety of crops with glufosinate-resistant traits, including Enlist crops. Its novel mode of action will manage existing or emerging herbicide resistance and provide fast, effective results. This means you can focus more on profitability and less on weeds. Nufarm and Cheetah Herbicide, here to help.
Back, you're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. We're right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag time, taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD, or you can email us radio@agphd.com. Get this one from John in Maryland, and he said there's a big push in our area to add more solar panels to try to generate power, and part of the driving factor here is they think it's more environmentally friendly. When you look at the data, cover crops will actually have an overall more positive impact on the planet than these various forms of quote-unquote clean energy.
Is this an older question?
Yeah.
Yeah, we covered this. I'm going to say we talked about this a month or two ago.
Well, I know John had called in, but I think he sent us some more information there, and he just said, this is a big deal in Maryland right now. Just appreciate anybody that could generate some conversation on this.
So his point was just, instead of taking the land and putting solar panels on it, you put cover crops on there.
Yes, put the solar panels on top of buildings and cities and these types of things. And I do totally agree with that there are spots where you aren't taking land out of production.
That's nice to say, but the cost to put the solar panels in is way higher if you put them on top of buildings. So that's the reason why they put it on the ground. I'm not saying it's the right thing to do. I'm just simply saying from pure economics, that's what they're looking at. And as a landowner in the United States, you can buy land and do almost whatever you would like to with it. So I get it. They go, well, it's a lot cheaper to do this than to deal with all these people that own buildings and try to get stuff way up on top of buildings. And then the other thing that ends up happening is, if somebody builds a building right next to it that's taller, all of a sudden this you don't get the sun anymore, and now you've got a problem again. So I totally understand why they do it.
Well, it doesn't mean we got to like it, that's for sure. Okay, got one from Matthew here, and he said, with your involvement with the Next Level Farming Show that's now airing on RFD TV, I'm just curious if you know, are these episodes available to rewatch or catch up on if you missed an episode? Thanks for the question, Matthew. And yeah, the Next Level Farming Show, it's pretty good. It's been fun being a part of that production team to help those guys get their show going. And you can get that on the RFD TV live streaming service. You need a subscription for that. But at this point, I think that's their only way they've got shows.
Well, aren't they rerunning the show?
They are rerunning the show too. And the other thing is their plan is to rerun them again. I believe their first series will have 26 episodes, so they're planning on airing them at least a couple of times. So, yeah, you'll see them a couple times each week, and then you may see a bunch of them re-aired again later. I don't know the exact plans on that, but yeah, in terms of just getting it on demand, you'll have to get on that RFD streaming service. Thanks, Matthew. Let's head up to Michigan. We got Dell on with a question about cation exchange capacity. Dell, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you. My question is, will compost change the number, and how many tons per acre would you need to change the number of your cation exchange capacity, please? Thank you.
All right, so thanks, Dell. In terms of cation exchange capacity, it is a measurement of the type of clay, the amount of clay, and the amount of organic matter that you have in your soil. Now, if you're out doing a soil test, and let's say there was compost or manure that was laid on the soil surface just before you're going to pull a soil sample, we would encourage you to kick the manure or the compost to the side. That is not fully broken down yet, and it has not yet become organic matter. So if you get that in there, is it going to throw your number off? Yes, but would it be an accurate number? No. So in terms of the question, how do you change that cation exchange capacity? We want more organic matter. Compost is a good thing. Compost is going to hopefully lead you to a little bit more organic matter over time. But in terms of number of tons per acre, I don't have the exact answer for that. But I would just say this. For a normal amount that you would put out there in a year, if you come back a year later, would you expect the organic matter level in the soil to be higher and therefore the cation exchange capacity to be higher? Probably not. But if it was, it would just be maybe 0.1 higher would be about it. So it's not going to make any dramatic change. Now, if over, let's say, a 20-year period, you use compost every year and you were no-tilling, because no-tilling is a much bigger factor than adding compost or manure, then absolutely you're going to increase that organic matter level, which will increase the cation exchange capacity level over a longer period of time. But is it going to happen in the short term? No.
All right. Thanks for the question. I get this one from Effendi, who said, "Hey, I'm located in Indonesia, and I'm using your AgPhD fertilizer removal app by crop. And I'm looking at corn. I'm just starting to raise some corn here. And I'm wondering what the difference is where it says Stover and grain and total. Can you explain to me what happens? I plan to just harvest the grain and leave the Stover in the field. How does that impact my fertility recommendation?"
Okay, so the grain is how much it takes to produce the grain, and the Stover is how much does it take to produce the Stover. If you were to take Stover off the field at the end of the year, do not think that all those nutrients that it took to produce the Stover will then go with the Stover for two reasons. Number one, half your Stover is below ground in the root system. That's typically what they say, is half is the roots. So half is already in the ground. And number two, there's more that will come out of those plants a lot of times before you take the Stover off. So just as an example, where we farm, it's corn, soybeans, and wheat, and there are people who will bale up that residue after harvest, whether it's corn stalks, the soybean stubble, or they'll bale up straw after their wheat. Okay, if let's say they get rain late in the season, after the plant has fully matured, if they get rain late in the season, or like right after harvest, before they're able to bale, there will be potassium that will typically leach out of that residue and end up down into the soil. So this is also, again, like I say, part of the reason why what's left in the Stover, if you were to bale it off, is not going to be what it took in total to produce the Stover. But anyway, let's say you leave all the residue out in the field, all the Stover's left out in the field. What we will typically tell you is, hey, if you just want to at least stay even in terms of total soil fertility, you need to put back whatever the grain actually removed, if the grain is what truly left the field. So, and we have kind of proven that out now over about 20 years of working on that, and obviously universities have as well. Our information comes from the International Plant Nutrition Institute, that we worked in conjunction with them to develop the AgPhD fertilizer removal app. So this is generally accepted worldwide information, and that's what I would take a look at. Now, obviously, if you want to build your soil test levels, you're going to have to put out more than what the grain is removing. But that kind of gives you a general idea of what you're looking for in terms of recommendations and removal from the field.
All right. Thanks for the questions. Got this from Jeff. He said, we're in the southwestern panhandle of Nebraska and down in the panhandle of Texas as well. We are planting some wheat, and we've got quite a few weeds in these areas. We've got bindweed, mare's tail, and mustard. I'm wondering what you'd recommend for that. A majority of this ground is irrigated, but we do have some small pieces of dry land here as well. So mare's tail, bindweed, and mustard in wheat.
Yeah, well, that's tough. And there. Oh, so this is one of the things, too. I've been an agronomist for 30 years now, full-time agronomist for 30 years. And it's always the most troublesome when farmers will say, hey, I've got these three different weeds. And I go, oh, no, I almost have to talk about three different herbicides, and you don't want to spend the kind of money for three different herbicides. But, and you did say wheat, right?
Yep.
Okay. So what I would start with would be Sharpen. What I would follow later with would be Husky. So that would be the general plan. The Sharpen burn down is going to take care of my mare's tail. It's hopefully going to take care of my field bindweed, but it might not completely get the bindweed. But your mustard's going to be taken care of by the Sharpen and the Husky. So the bindweed would be a little questionable, but still, for me, I would try Sharpen down, Husky over the top. I'm not spending a fortune, but I should have real good weed control and good residual. Well, we'll answer more of your questions in the Ag PhD mailbag right after this.
We now bring you an important news bulletin.
This just in from Live Action News.
Innovation has come to the world of burndown.
New Elevore herbicide controls your toughest weeds, even glyphosate and ALS-resistant weeds like mare's tail and henbit. Talk with your retailer about Elevore herbicide today and ask how you can start elevating your burndown.
The only innovation that matters is the one I need.
With NK Seeds, their R&D program actually listens to farmers like me, so I get solutions that solve my challenges.
With the support to make them count. Because progress means pushing my potential, and success matters.
Push your potential at nkseeds.com.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
Each year brings new and unique challenges to farming, and your operation needs to constantly adapt to meet them. That's why at AgBiome, we're working every day to bring you new and better solutions. Microbial-based solutions that protect your crop and help it reach its full potential. To learn more about how we're doing it, visit agbiome.com. That's AGBIOME.com. AgBiome, feeding the world responsibly. Partnering with microbes for human benefit.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Vellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Vellum. For more information, visit vellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
A history of success means proven performance, but let's call performance what it is. Profitability and boosting yours, no matter what the season brings, is the goal of DeKalb brand corn. Backed by exclusive genetics, whole farm solutions, and unmatched dealer support, let nothing shake your perseverance. Ask your dealer how DeKalb brand corn can help you realize a future of performance. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag time here, and there's still time for you to get a call in if you've got an agronomic question or just want to talk about what's happening on your farm. Phone lines are open at 844-44-AG-PHD. Got an email here from Keith in Texas. He said, I just recently bought some land in the Texas Hill Country, getting ready to put it in to some pollinator plants. Said, I've got a high soil pH, though. Just wondering what you would do to bring that down, if elemental sulfur or ammonium sulfate would work. I'm putting on 400 pounds of magnesium sulfate, 100 pounds of a micronutrient blend, 100 pounds of 1846O, and 50 pounds of potash.
Okay. I was just saying to Darren during the break, he handed me the soil test during a break, and I said, you know, this is a little unusual because a lot of times when we see a high pH, a pH over 7, we will see sodium high, or salts are high, or Let's see, what else do I have here? I look at magnesium, and none of those things are high. In fact, all those things are low. In this soil, it legitimately just is lots of calcium. So what it comes back to, don't ever forget that pH is just a representation of your nutrient balance in the soil. So when your pH is way out of whack, now I wouldn't call this way out of whack. It's only at 7.6. It's not the end of the world. It's not 9 or 4 or something like that. But anyway, when it's way out of whack, then it tells us we just have a nutrient imbalance. And it sounds like you're working on fixing these things, because I was just going to say, yeah, you're low on magnesium, phosphorus, sulfur, zinc, iron, copper, boron. You're low on virtually everything on here. And I would just say your potassium isn't overly high. It's just barely enough. So if you work on getting all those nutrients straightened up, that's the first thing I would do. And I don't know that I would worry that much about the pH in year one or year two. I would just say, you know, I got to fix these other things. Once you get those other things fixed, you never know. That pH might start to neutralize. And over time, it might get a lot better. Also, when you have better plant growth, that means better root growth, that means more organic acids are released into the soil. They are considered chelating agents, and the plant kicks those out to try to turn nutrients into forms that the plants can use. So what I'm saying is the plants will naturally start to lower your soil pH a little bit, and I believe you shouldn't have to do a tremendous amount, but if anything, it might be elemental sulfur. So let's put it this way. You need sulfur anyway. So rather than just doing a whole bunch of sulfates, and that's fine. I mean, like you needed magnesium sulfate, I get that. But I'm just saying rather than using maybe ammonium sulfate or certainly gypsum, you could maybe consider using a little bit of elemental sulfur. That'll give you slow release on sulfur anyway. Your soil's not like super heavy, but it's also not super light. It's 18 for cation exchange capacity. We'd call that kind of on the high end of a medium textured soil. So having a little bit of slow release sulfur might be good for you anyway. And yes, elemental sulfur can slowly lower that soil pH just a little bit.
All right. Thanks for the question. We appreciate that. So back to the phone lines here. We've got Paul on in Minnesota. Paul, how are you doing?
Not too bad. Got a question for you, and maybe I'm the only one in the world that doesn't know the answer to this, but we deal with a lot of turkey litter, and my question is, we've been using a product, Decomp, to compost the turkey litter. How do you know when a pile is composted? I mean, what are the telltale signs? Or, you know, because we've had piles that have sat for, you know, 6 months to a year. And so is that compost or is that still just rotted litter?
Sure. Yeah. So typically some of the signs you're looking for compost, and by the way, it doesn't necessarily, and it's not this many times clean thing of, okay, I have manure, and now after X number of days, it is definitely compost and it's all 100% compost. But What typically happens is the pile will heat way up and then it will cool back down. And so once your temperature starts to moderate again and get close to what the ambient temperature is, and also when that smell goes away to some degree, those are a couple of the things that I would look for. So when you buy, for example, potting soil in the hardware store, that's usually just compost. And when you feel that, it's not hot and it doesn't have this bad smell to it. So when those two things have gone away, the smell and the heat, then a lot of times you have now ended up with compost.
Okay. Do you have time for one more quick
question?
Sure,
you bet. Go ahead.
So we had, we emptied our barns here late in the fall, and we still had ground that we could apply. I normally don't like to spread raw litter, manure, on corn stalks like that going into corn next year. But we did. How should that have been done? I did ask one agronomist about, you know, do you put the Decomp on that litter before you apply it to the ground, or do you apply the litter and run the decomp through the planter in the spring in furrow? What would you have done?
Yep. What I would have done is probably exactly what you did, is gotten rid of that litter as fast as I could, because knowing how your weather is, it's similar to our weather. In like 2 days, it can completely change, and all of a sudden, you don't have the opportunity to get it out. And when you need to get it out, you got to get it out. So I would have just put it out there just like you did. I probably would have then sprayed decomp right away. Like for us this fall, we did spray some decomp where we had lots of residue, and we just combined it in with a herbicide. So we were actually getting our spring herbicide pass done because we had time. This was an unusual fall where we actually had time. You know, it was warm, and we said, hey, let's just get going on this. So we did some of that. So if it was me, I would have spread the litter. I would have just sprayed if I still had time to do that. Otherwise, what I might do is just wait until spring and then spray decomp and go from there. But here's the thing. If you put raw litter out there, I don't love seeing raw litter just sit there, because what ends up happening is some of that nitrogen can go up in the air. So typically what we would tell a person is, either if you're going to get rain quickly, I mean, that would really help. I'd try to get a little decomp on, but otherwise just that rain's hopefully going to move some of that nitrogen down in the ground. Otherwise, I'd try to work it in as fast as I could. So a lot of times when we spread fall manure, that's what we do, is just try to work it in right away.
And that's what we did. We did incorporate.
Good. Yep.
But I did the Norwegian thing where we did one barn, we sprayed the decomp in the barn, we rototilled it, mixed it up, and spread it on the field, worked it in.
Yep.
The other barn, we took it out raw and went that route. And I think we're going to run at least some in furrow next spring.
Yeah, see, that sounds good to me. I mean, so you got a bunch of ways to try that. There are a lot of these biological microbial products that have come out now where we think they have a lot of promise. We're experimenting with them all the time too, and it's a good idea always as a farmer to try it on your farm, run some different tests, see what you see. If the stuff pays, great, you continue to do it. If it doesn't pay, then you go away from it. But yeah, you've got three different trial methods now, so hopefully something will pan out for you, and it leads to a little more profitability.
Yep, thank you very much.
You bet. Yep, thanks for calling, Paul. Appreciate it.
You bet.
All right, got this question from Ryan in Canada. He said, I've heard some farmers are using Dual 2 Magnum and Frontier Max early post-emergent dry edible beans from first to third trifoliate. I also read they could tank mix Bassegran when they're spraying that post-emergent. Do you have any knowledge of this? Also, do Dual or Frontier have any activity post-emerge themselves?
I was just going to look up. So Canada has a different label. And up in Canada, yeah, they've got Frontier Max, for example, versus we have Outlook in the United States, both from BSF, both dimethenamid. I was just going to see if they had it labeled up there for early post. That's a good question, and I got like 10 seconds to try to figure this out. So I'm not finding it on the label, but I do not believe that's labeled for early post. Well, at least the Dual isn't labeled for early post.
And the last part of that question, too, do Dual or Frontier have any activity by themselves post-emerge? No, they don't. They're not contact killers. They are soil residual products that have to get taken up by the weeds as they're just starting to germinate.
So soybeans early post, corn early post, you know, products like Outlook, Frontier Max, Dual, fine. I don't think in dry beans they're labeled, but you just have to check on the label in your area.
All right, thanks for the questions. We really appreciate that. And thanks to you for listening. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio. Now stay tuned for Rob Sharkey and Shark Farmer Radio.